This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what's behind the growing rift between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Rivalry between Riyadh and Tehran is nothing new. Iran's 1979 revolution all but guaranteed competition between the Shia-dominated former Persia, now Iran, and Saudi Arabia, custodian of the two holiest mosques in Mecca and Medina. Oil-rich Saudi Arabia has been an important, long-standing strategic ally of the United States, and today they are part of a U.S.-led coalition to defeat the so-called Islamic State. But Riyadh is feeling defensive of late. More than 35 years of hostile U.S.-Iranian relations may be coming to a close with the imminent implementation of the nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Saudi Arabia is angry at the United States for courting Iran and not doing enough to pressure the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who attacked his own citizens and sparked a horrific civil conflict. Riyadh's costly war against the Houthis in Yemen, who receive assistance from Iran, along with falling oil prices, the commodity on which the kingdom has depended for the bulk of its revenues, add to its mounting woes. But it was the execution of a popular Shiite cleric, Nimr al-Nimr, by the Saudi monarchy, which precipitated the latest war of words and actions between Riyadh and Tehran. Saudi Arabia executed al-Nimr, who advocated an end to economic and social discrimination against Saudi Arabia's minority Shiites, but the monarchy saw behind him the hand of Iran. Al-Nimr was put to death along with 46 other mostly Sunni prisoners earlier this month. Then, after protesters stormed the Saudi embassy in Tehran, Riyadh severed diplomatic ties with the Islamic Republic. Sunni Arab allies, including Bahrain and Sudan, also cut ties with Tehran. The latest friction comes at a key moment for both states. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani was elected in 2013 with a pledge to open up his country to the outside world, revive the economy, and pursue at least limited social reforms. Saudi Arabia's King Salman ascended to the throne just 1 year ago and has shown signs of acting in a more decisive manner than his predecessors. His boldest move has been a bombing campaign in Yemen, where Saudis and Iran are on opposite sides of that country's war. Well, with us to discuss the reasons behind and the ramifications of the widening gulf between Saudi Arabia and Iran are two distinguished regional analysts. Hussein Ibish is senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Previously, he was a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine. And Robert Wirth, he's contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Robert previously served as New York Times bureau chief in Beirut. He's the author of the forthcoming book, A Rage for Order, The Middle East in Turmoil, From Tahrir Square to ISIS. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Nice to be here.
Well, Hussein Ibish, let me begin with you.
Sure.
And talking about the execution of the Shiite cleric, to what extent do you think this was motivated primarily by domestic politics, perhaps to appease hardliners in the kingdom, or to what extent was it really directed against the arch-rival Iran?
Well, I think that there is a series of messages that are being sent to different constituencies simultaneously through the execution. And it's important to contextualize it in two ways. One, as you noted, the majority of those executed, and this is the second mass execution in Saudi Arabia's contemporary history. In this case, 47 people were put to death, 43 of them being accused al-Qaeda members, Sunni extremists. Nimr al-Nimr, though, I should say, was not just an advocate for Shiite rights in Saudi Arabia and against discrimination. He was an advocate of secession. He wanted the eastern province, which is the oil-rich and Shiite-majority portion of Saudi Arabia, to actually secede from Saudi Arabia. And that's a red line that I think Saudi Arabia wanted to tell everyone is not going to be tolerated. So the message first to the domestic audiences, to the Shiites, is don't talk about secession because it really is apt to get you executed. It's that bad, especially if we think you're advocating violence, which they, I think, really do believe he was. Secondly, to al-Qaeda extremists, you face death. The message to Iran is, we're prepared to raise the stakes. We're not afraid of you, and we're willing to confront you. And if we take a decision to execute both al-Qaeda members and dissident secessionist Shiite clerics, we'll do that, and we don't care what you say. And to the United States, it's a message that your leadership is lacking, and we're not going to ask you first. We're going to do what we need to, and we expect your support. But if we don't get it, well, that's the way it's going to go.
Turning to you, Robert Wirth, for your take on the messages sent by the execution of Nimr al-Nimr, which seems to have precipitated this series of events and the severing of diplomatic ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
I would agree with everything Hussein said. I think the Saudis feel that they cannot count on America any longer. For a very long time, they felt that their security guarantee was the United States, that they wouldn't take any major decisions without consulting the United States. And in this case, there were, I think, diplomatic signals sent from Washington. This is a bad idea. Do not execute this cleric. It's going to cause all kinds of ruckus. And they made a point of saying, no, you know, you're not our bosses in this respect. We feel that you're not protecting us. You don't have our back anymore. They felt that, as Hussein said, that the Iran deal was a very bad thing for them and for the region. They feel that it has unleashed Iran. That, in other words, that by containing Iran, at least temporarily, from a nuclear weapon, that they feel that the Iranians now feel they can do anything else in the region, including the things that most threaten the Saudis, which is, you know, all kinds of aggression in Lebanon, in Syria, where the Saudis have watched for years now as, what is it now, 300,000 people have been killed. And there is, of course, a sectarian element there as well in Syria, which is that the rebellion is essentially a Sunni rebellion against a regime that is led by Alawites. And the Saudis have watched this and felt our Sunni brothers are being slaughtered. And who is guiding the slaughter? It may be Bashar al-Assad nominally, but who's behind it? Iran. So they feel literally that they are surrounded and under siege by Iran. And I think they want to send a signal, we are not going to consult anybody about this, including the Americans. And we want to send a signal to Iran, we're not afraid of you. It's very much of a piece with a signal that the Saudis are sending with their war in Yemen. We're not scared of you.
Interesting. Hussein Ibish, because I've read some opinion editorials saying that the actions by the monarchy with respect to the execution, particularly of this Shiite cleric, sends a signal that they're afraid. Yeah. But you're saying no, both
of you
actually. Not.
Yeah, I think not. Things are not going well for Saudi Arabia, all right? That's the undeniable fact that one has to accept. They've got a whole range of problems that Robert just beautifully recited in terms of Iran's ascendancy and the nuclear deal sort of freeing them from the shackles that they've been under and rehabilitating them in the eyes of the West and kind of legitimating their regional role without them changing their regional policies, only their nuclear policies, which is very alarming to Saudi Arabia. But in addition to that, there's this enormous financial pressure that they've come under in terms of the price of oil, which has really severely damaged their economy and damaged their budget. They are a society in which the public, there's a sort of social contract in Saudi Arabia where the public expects a great deal from the government, and the government has to provide it on the basis of the oil revenues. And Saudi Arabia has been a major player in suppressing the price of oil to try to get at Iran, but it's hurting them a great deal. So across the board, they're in real trouble. From that, people extrapolate panic. But if you actually look at the actions, the words, the deeds, and all of that put together, it looks, on the contrary, like confidence, maybe even overconfidence, and possibly even hubris, more than panic.
Interesting that you bring up that hubris. So let me turn to you, Robert Wirth, to talk about what's really going on in the kingdom now that King Salman has ascended the throne, especially talk about his son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who seems to be quite the mover and the shaker behind the throne.
Well, it's been a year, and his son, Mohammed bin Salman, is actually not the Crown Prince, but the second in line to the throne. However, he seems to be essentially running the kingdom. He's 30 years old, and he's seems to have a sophisticated grasp of the economy, but he also seems to have quite a headstrong, aggressive approach to things. He seems to be in charge of the war in Yemen, as we understand it. He's also taking on some very serious, dramatic economic reforms. Economics is where he sees that he will make his mark. Again, he may not be the next king, although he may. It's possible that the second in line will be scrapped. There's a lot of speculation about that. But it seems likely that he will eventually be king, and he has plenty of time. And he talked in a recent Economist interview about they're going to, for the first time, bring in VAT and other kinds of taxes, not income taxes, because that would really break with the social contract whereby we provide oil and you don't get any democracy. But they will begin to make people pay some kind of taxes. He's talked about privatizing aspects of the economy. They're going to reduce subsidies, they say, and a raft of other economic and financial changes. He wants to make the kingdom less dependent on oil. These are all things that have been talked about for years, but he seems to be really taking them on. So he's gotten some credit for that. Of course, you know, what King Salman has done in putting his son essentially in charge of the country, he's put aside much of the way that the Saudis worked for. Everything was done by consensus. Right. You had a king, but you also had lots of senior princes who were involved in the decisions, and that was part of the reason why everything was so slow and deliberative in Saudi Arabia. Well, all of a sudden, major decisions are being made very fast, and you have essentially the king and his son, and perhaps to some extent Mohammed bin Nayef, who's the crown prince, who are the decision makers, and nobody else really matters as far as we can tell.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Hussein Ibish, he's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Robert Wirth, former Beirut bureau chief for The New York Times, currently contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine. And we're talking about the significance and implications of the growing rift between Saudi Arabia and Iran. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to our loyal listener from Istanbul, Turkey, Seref Kilic. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. or like us on Facebook. Well, let's continue our discussion. Back to you, Hussein Ibish, to talk about the Iran deal, this nuclear deal. To what extent do you see the actions of Saudi Arabia, whether vis-a-vis Yemen, their more aggressive actions there, which some are criticizing because of many civilian casualties, and also the recent executions. To what extent does the sectarian divide, that is their disdain for Shiites, which I think we need to talk about to some extent, and to what extent is it the rising role of Iran in the region and the particularly with respect to the implementation day, which is imminent, which will allow Iran to receive sanctions relief. And many are concerned about where this sanctions relief is going to go.
Right.
Will it prop up their nefarious activities in the region? To what extent is it sectarian, and how much of it has to do with this deal, particularly the sanctions relief?
The biggest single irritant by far for the Saudis vis-a-vis their relationship with Iran, and also, by extension, their relationship with the United States, is the benefits that Iran is going to get from the nuclear deal. First, the influx of money that they're expecting in the form of sanctions relief that you mentioned, and the general rehabilitation of Iran. The United States and the other, therefore, Western powers, treating Iran as a much more legitimate player. And as I said before, without Iran changing the policies that not only Saudi Arabia, but the West has objected to so strenuously over time, Iran has made a big point of saying and demonstrating that its policies on Syria, on Yemen, etc., regionally, haven't changed at all. And if anything, they've doubled down on their policies. And so what the Saudis kind of believe is that this nuclear deal comes at their expense, because their concern about Iran is not primarily a nuclear-armed Iran like the United States, the West, and Israel. It is more concerned about the idea of Iran as a rising hegemonic power. Shiite, a Persian, non-Arab power extending its tentacles, as they see it, deep into the Arab world, not just into Lebanon, but into Syria, into Iraq, into Bahrain, into Yemen. So I do definitely think that the notion that Iran is going to get a windfall of money in the form of sanctions relief and this wave of legitimation at the same time as it's continuing to pursue policies that used to be, you know, universally opposed and now are just kind of ignored because of the nuclear issue is the single biggest factor driving their policies. But I do just want to say one thing. This tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia is not millennia old, as President Obama suggested during the State of the Union address. I think that's what he meant. But it does date back to the Iranian Revolution. There was tension under the Shah, but really, ever since the 1979 Iranian Revolution, and particularly beginning in Lebanon, there has been tension and regional proxy conflicts between Iran and Saudi Arabia over power, over ideology, over influence and hegemony. And it used to be proxies versus proxies. But now you have two examples of direct confrontation of one side against the proxies of the other. In Syria, Iranian forces and their allies are directly confronting proxies and clients of Saudi Arabia. And in Yemen, Saudi Arabian forces and Emirati forces and others are directly confronting clients and allies of Iran. And that takes it to a whole nother level. And so certainly I think this is becoming intensified.
Turning back to you, Robert Wirth, to talk more about how much the nuclear deal, or perhaps better said, the way it was negotiated with Iran and the P5+1, that is the driving force behind what Saudi Arabia is doing in a more aggressive manner. So let me ask you this question. If the United States and the other powers had negotiated the nuclear deal with Iran, but also demonstrated its pledge to hold Tehran accountable for these other violations in the region or nefarious activities, had they not flinched in helping the Syrian opposition defend itself, for example, against Bashar al-Assad, perhaps established a no-fly zone or safe zone, would things have been different?
I just think that it would have been probably impossible to form a deal that would have clipped Iran's wings in terms of its regional influence. I don't think they would have been willing to give that up. And I think the deal will involve more money coming to Iran. I'm not so sure that's going to translate into an awful lot more activity in terms of their interference in Syria and Lebanon and so forth, because they've been doing that all along.
Right.
And they would rather, you know, see their people begin to starve and continue doing that kind of political work than cut it back. They see the loss of Syria. That is to say, if Syria were to go to become a country that's fully allied with the West and not at all with Iran, they see that as existential. They need to have Syria being run by a friendly power. So I just think you have kind of irreconcilable differences here. And as Hussein said, it's not about ancient conflicts between Sunni and Shia, but the difference between Persian and Arab powers does go back centuries. And in
right.
some ways, Sunni and Shia is just new coloring for, let's say, a power conflict that is very, very old. What the Saudis want ultimately is to be reassured about Iranian power in the region in a way that is just incompatible with who the Iranians see themselves. The Iranians see themselves as the big power in the Gulf. To them, it's the Persian Gulf. To the Saudis, it's the Arabian Gulf. And I think they feel that it's only natural that they should exercise influence, given the fact that there are, in fact, Shiite communities around the region with whom they have really ancient links. The Shiites of southern Lebanon, which is Hezbollah's base of population, goes back many centuries. And the way Iranians see it is that they are surrounded by American bases and by Arabs who are wanting to control and push them back. And they say that's just not fair, it's not just.
Two quick points, if I may. One is that it's important to note that when Iran became Shiite a few centuries ago, that conversion was led by clerics imported from Lebanon, so that Iran's Shiaism is rooted in a certain sense in the Arab world. The other thing that's very important to note is that you've had a rise of extremism on both sides. You've had a loss of the former, more conciliatory centers of Al-Azhar in Egypt and Najaf in Iraq, and the rise of more bellicose religious centers in Qum in Iran and in Saudi Arabia, frankly, among Sunnis. And so you've got a real rise of confrontationalism among Sunnis and Shiites here in the Middle East that I think, as Robert exactly rightly says, colors a conflict that isn't actually millennial religious divide.
We do have to note that this puritanical Wahhabi doctrine emanating from Saudi Arabia is an interpretation of Islam which is not practiced far and wide in
That's
the Sunni
right.
world. And it is at the root of, or at least an ideological root of many of these terrorist groups.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And of course, we noted that the foreign minister of Iran wrote an opinion editorial in the New York Times excoriating Saudi Arabia for their terrorism, supporting terrorism.
and saying that many of the 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. All of this is true, but it is a bit disingenuous.
There's a good deal there's a good deal of Ayatollah Pot meeting Sheikh Black and discussing things.
Right. Of course, he didn't mention that his country backs
Indeed.
The butcher of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, who's using chemical weapons and barrel bombs against his own people, and they, of course, supporting him to the hilt.
Nor a series of bombings, including American installations in Beirut and whatnot.
Or executing 700 of their own people in the first half of last year alone. Anyway, equal opportunity critics, we are here. But let me ask you quickly, Hussein Ibish, about the United States. If we could roll back, could they have negotiated the nuclear deal differently? Maybe not negotiated it differently, but we heard President Obama say time after time that we are compartmentalizing, we're going to negotiate the nuclear deal, hold them accountable, we're going to stop them from getting a weapon, a very important goal.
Right.
One asks, what would the alternative be?
Yeah.
But many are criticizing President Obama, in particular the administration, for not driving a harder bargain. That is, while Bashar al-Assad was running roughshod over his own people, some critics think that perhaps the administration was a little reticent to do more to back the opposition, to give them the defensive weaponry, to help them more politically, for fear that it would jeopardize the Iran deal. Now, my question to you is hypothetical.
Yeah.
Had they driven a harder bargain, do you think that would have derailed the Iran nuclear deal? So in that way, did President Obama choose the nuclear deal over Syria?
Yes, I think he did. But I think Robert is exactly correct. You couldn't have negotiated a tougher deal on the nuclear issue, nor could you have successfully brought these other issues to the table and negotiated them with Iran. Iran simply wouldn't have agreed to curtail its activities. But what you could have done is achieved pretty much this agreement, which is a major accomplishment for American diplomacy. But at the same time, given that Iran has said that its other policies haven't changed, the United States was under no compulsion to amend its policies, but we have done so, clearly. At least our allies believe it. The Saudis believe it, the Israelis believe it, and I think most of the world believes it. And certainly Syria is the key example. So the United States had a red line about chemical weapons. Bashar al-Assad crossed that red line, and he, in effect, was rewarded with an agreement that enhanced his legitimacy and sort of required him to keep hold of those parts of his country that allowed him to implement that agreement. It was a windfall for him. And across the board, the United States, I think, has chosen to kind of make nice with Iran on issues that the Iranians don't make nice with the United States about, to maintain the general good humor when that's really not necessary. I think it's pretty clear that the Iranians would have taken this deal as is, and there's no need to do the bending over backwards that we're currently doing, in my opinion. And I do think that the Saudis and the Israelis and others could have been greatly reassured by a stronger American position on Iran's policies in Syria and elsewhere. And unfortunately, it didn't happen. And I think it's been a big mistake.
Well, Robert, just to get your take, had the United States enforced the red line, again, this has nothing to do with the nuclear deal, had they enforced the red line, been more supportive of allies in the region who wanted to do more to help the rebel opposition who rose up against Bashar al-Assad, who was barrel bombing them and sniping them from the rooftops. Had the United States done that in parallel to negotiating the deal, would that have been perceived by the Iranians as basically...
Would that have killed the deal?
Yeah, killed the deal.
I don't think it would have. I agree with Hussein about that. But I wanted to add that I think there's another kind of price that's been paid for this deal, which is that we didn't just need to keep the Iranians on board for this deal. We needed to keep our allies on board for this deal, in particular the Saudis. And when you look, for instance, at what's happened in Yemen, the Saudis have been bombing Yemen for coming up on a year now. And the American government has been supportive of that in a kind of a grumbling way. I mean, we've gone along, we've helped them find targets and stuff, but American military officials have made very clear they thought this was a bad idea from the start. And there have been a lot of civilian casualties. There's been destruction of UNESCO sites. And the war continues without seeming to achieve its primary goal, which was to oust the Houthi rebels.
Now, these rebels, Hadi.
That's right. Now, the Houthi rebels are seen by the Saudis as a proxy for Iran. The truth is that the Houthis are an indigenous movement, which for years and years, despite many accusations, did not receive any substantial support from Iran. It was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Finally, a few years ago, they did start to receive support, but it's still not that much. Saudi Arabia has certainly contributed a lot more to its allies in Yemen than the Houthis have ever received from Iran. So I think the point could be made that the Americans should have intervened and said, look, what is the point of this war? What are you achieving here? Why are you doing it? But I think at least part of the reason that they didn't do that was the nuclear deal. We felt we had to keep all of our allies on side, which meant essentially not criticizing anybody, whether it was Iran or Saudi Arabia.
I'm afraid on that rather pessimistic note, that's all the time we have. On this edition of Encounter, I'd like to thank my guests, Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Robert Wirth, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.